All right, good afternoon, everyone, and we are continuing our discussion this week of Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? And we started on this article 2 weeks ago from Gene Twenge. He's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, and it's an eight-page article that we started on, and we got through almost 3 pages.
We'll get through more today.
And so we will pick up where we left off on page 3 of the article. Brian, go ahead. Independence isn't free.
Independence isn't free. You need some money in your pocket to pay for gas or for that bottle of schnapps. In earlier eras, kids worked in great numbers, eager to finance their freedom or prodded by their parents to learn the value of a dollar. But iGen teens aren't working or managing their own money as much. In the late 1970s, 77% of high school seniors worked for pay during the school year. By the mid-2010s, only 55% did. The number of eighth graders who worked for pay has been cut in half. These declines accelerated during the Great Recession, but teen employment has not bounced back, even though job availability has. Of course, putting off the responsibilities of adulthood is not an iGen innovation. Gen Xers in the 1990s were the first to postpone the traditional markers of adulthood. Young Gen Xers were just about as likely to drive, drink alcohol, and date as young boomers had been, and more likely to have sex and get pregnant as teens. But as they left their teenage years behind, Gen Xers married and started careers later than their boomer predecessors had. Gen X managed to stretch adolescence beyond all previous limits. Its members started becoming adults earlier and finished becoming adults later. Beginning with millennials and continuing with iGen, adolescence is contracting again, but only because its onset is being delayed. Across a range of behaviors, drinking, dating, spending time unsupervised, 18-year-olds now act more like 15-year-olds used to, and 15-year-olds more like 13-year-olds used to. Childhood now stretches well into high school. Why are today's teens waiting longer to take on both the responsibilities and the pleasures of adulthood? Shifts in the economy and parenting certainly play a role. In an information economy that rewards higher education more than an early work history, parents may be inclined to encourage their kids to stay home and study rather than to get a part-time job. Teens, in turn, seem to be content with this homebody arrangement. Not because they're so studious, but because their social life is lived on their phone. They don't need to leave home to spend time with their friends. If today's teens were a generation of grinds, we'd see that in the data. But 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in the 2010s actually spend less time on homework than Gen X teens did in the early 1990s. High school seniors headed for four-year colleges spend about the same amount of time on homework as their predecessors did. The time that seniors spend on activities such as student clubs and sports and exercise has changed little in recent years. Combined with the decline in working for pay, this means that iGen teens have more leisure time than Gen X teens did, not less. So what are they doing with all that time? They are on their phone, in their room, alone, and often distressed.
Well, I find that really, really crazy that Gen X spent more time on homework than the current students. That's just amazing.
Did she say more or equal? They spent about the same time?
Yeah. 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in the 2010s spent less time on homework than Gen X teens did in the early 1990s.
Okay, right. And then high schoolers that are heading to college were about the same.
Mm-hmm.
That compared. So you're thinking
that's the earlier ones spending less time on homework. And I would say the reason why the high school seniors are doing that is because they now woke up to the realization that they're about to go to college and they're trying to catch up.
Yeah. That's definitely something.
Just from the trends that we see now, I'm a Gen X. I graduated in 1990, so I'm on that early edge side of Gen X.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember our semester exams were 33% of our semester grade.
Right.
They were one-third of it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we just enacted a 10% and we got major pushback because it's too big of a cut into the semester grade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Academically, Jackie, what has, is it just progressive education as a whole that's led to the decline in homework?
Well, I think it's the idea that, well, there's two end markers in play. One, global awareness is a huge issue. And now that we have these huge global studies, and Gen X had them, and we were starting to see the reports of them, but, you know, it takes a while to turn a big ship like education. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing the effects of that turn now more than we did when it was first being studied to do the turns. The turns were being planned.
Yeah.
So what happened was is these huge studies came out, and the Asian culture do more homework than Americans, but what really messed things up was when Finland and Norway and these guys became number one, number two, number threes in their countries, and there was a false perception that they don't do homework. They do homework, but they do very little homework.
Mm-hmm.
It's very targeted. It's very specific for the educational goals. They don't do worksheets every night and everything else. They might do a week-long assignment.
Mm-hmm.
That is manageable, progressive. You have to do step A, to do step B, to do step C, to do step D. So it feels like less work. It looks like less work because it's more bite-sized versus 10 problems tonight, 10 problems tomorrow night, 10 problems the next night, 10 problems the next night, kind of feeling that mm-hmm. America still has. So we got this idea of, you know, well, let's make it more participation grades, let's make it more this, let's make it more that, or it's too hard, we're piling it on, let's pull it off, because evidently homework doesn't, well, the Asians' cultures, only their best students take the test, because they've been weeded out to vocations before that.
Mm-hmm.
Over here, yeah, all of them are going to school, but they're not doing as much homework. So maybe that's the route to go. And really, America's kind of lost in the middle of trying to figure out where to go and what to do with all of this. And right now, it's not working.
Yeah.
To truly prepare students for the world. So now with more time, yeah, they're retreating to their phones, and we see a higher level of, I don't want to say social awkwardness, because that has such a stigma to it, but we see students who are less capable of knowing how to handle interpersonal reaction face to face,
which is so strange considering that they're obligated by their state and federal government to spend X number of hours in a public setting, having conversations with, listening to teachers, and regardless of even the homework level.
But they're not, because more and more schools are pushing a one-to-one delivery system for education. So if anything, we're increasing their time and devices and making it more individualized even in their homework settings, so that you know, that's why the Carpe Diem schools were so effective and took off so well, is really think about it. A Carpe Diem school operates with 8 total teachers. And they go up to like the 8th grade. Like K-5 to 8th grade, they have 8 teachers total and an administrator. And they even have 300 students. And what they do is they just have a big warehouse floor. And they put a bunch of cubicles in.
So it's like ACU.
And the kids have delivered onware software lessons, and they do their lessons and they work on it and everything else. And when they do an assessment, it rates where their gaps were by standards, and now supplements their next lesson with where they had gaps and moves them along. But every day they're required to spend 30 minutes with a core teacher. So they rotate up to the core teachers, and then the other 4 teachers are the teachers who are walking the floor in case you need help or you're off task, and they just come by and help you get back on task.
Hmm.
You know, and those schools are really into their devices more.
You've heard me mention, and when Bill was here, he mentioned as well a book called Outliers.
Yeah,
and in one of the main concepts, I guess, that grabbed attention in headlines when Outliers came out a few years ago, was that they studied specifically some hockey players, but they were looking at trends and data, and they were trying to figure out why some of them did better than others. And one of the things that came out of that book, or the one thing that impressed me when I read it, because it resonated with me as a musician who spent time in his room practicing his instrument, is that it takes 10,000 hours for you to get professional or proficient at a task, or a profession, a group of tasks. And so I've been thinking about this a lot, and it kind of dovetails with this cell phone thing, because we talk about homework. You know, I'll give myself as an example. I would go to the room to do homework. Go to my bedroom. Got sent to my bedroom. Go do your homework, okay? If it was homework I liked, I would be focused, and I would just start problem one or whatever and just get through it. I would even do more if I liked it. Reading. I really liked reading. I loved science, historical things, liked those kind of things. I did not like math. So when it came to math, I would do a problem, then I'd look outside. I wasn't doing anything productive. Then I'd do another problem, and then I'd mess with something else in my room. And then because I didn't really want to do it. You know what I mean?
Kids today do it during the commercials on TV.
I don't even think they watch TV. Yeah. So what I'm trying to get to is, I think that more now than ever, there is this distraction of the phone.
Right.
So they'll be doing homework. And they'll even maybe be using a tablet or a computer to do their homework, but they can bop over to Instagram or bop over to Facebook and whatever. And so the problem is, one of the other things that was interesting from that book is, you know, if you spend about 19 or 20 minutes on a task, you reach about like a saturation limit before your mind can move on. So, like, say I was working on a scale to play for my instrument. They found that if you work 30 minutes on the scale, 50 minutes on the scale, you're really doing about as much to progress yourself as if you worked 19 minutes on that scale. So what I'm talking about is efficiency. And the thing about it is, because there's no big change in so what I used to do is, you know, I would be in my math book, and then I'd maybe mess around with something or read another book or go play outside for 10 minutes and come back in. There's no change in venue. They're on the same device. And so there's not a mental break that's needed. So learning isn't going as quickly or as efficiently as it could. And then the other part of this is this whole idea of simple repetitive tasks. That Dave Gibbs used to talk about, that used to always resonate with me, because that's one of the reasons I became a good French horn player, is because I sat in my room and I did the same thing over and over. It wasn't like I did it once, okay, I got it, it's good. No, someone somewhere early along the process told me that, you know, you need to do, if you want to be able to perform this in performance like 80% well, you need to be able to do it 100% every time in your bedroom when you're practicing your instrument. And so I think a lot of these tactile tasks have been just taken out of the educational forum. And so what we're asking kids to do is we're asking them to learn by just listening to me. I'm going to talk for 50 minutes. You listen and you'll be educated. That's not the way it works. I think most people will find that you learn much better when you do something. And that's why I'm just going to go on record, I don't like homework. I think a lot of times homework is not the most efficient way to learn.
I agree.
And I think that what they need to do is they need to do the homework in the class with the student. But what does this really come down to? People can't manage classrooms. You can't have 18 people or even 12 people working on tasks and keep them quiet anymore. You know,
no,
the teacher can't.
I can do that with
you know. And then the other part of this is, I'm, of course, a band director, and so I'm always for larger class size. I want 60 students in my classroom. I want 100 students in my classroom. But what's the difference? Yeah, I wouldn't want 100 students if they were all working on their own thing.
You're just a mouthpiece in all of their mouths.
Right, exactly.
And then they can't talk.
They're doing something. It's a coordinated effort. They're not all doing the same thing. They're learning to work together, but it's a coordinated effort in which they're doing something. And if you've ever been involved in a good and a bad program, the difference is the ones that keep them occupied, you know, and move from song to song without talking. Like in my band, you didn't even talk. I mean, that was unheard of, to even say a word in between songs. You know, And so it's so different today, and I think that's part of the reason why, is because we never really turn our mind off from the kind of learning that we're doing and move from the device. Now I think they even watch TV on their phones.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they don't even go to the television set anymore.
One of the ironies of the iGen life is that despite spending far more time under the same roof as their parents, today's teens can hardly be said to be closer to their mothers and fathers than their predecessors were. I've seen my friends with their families. They don't talk to them, Athena told me. They just say, okay, whatever, while they're on their phones. They don't pay attention to their family. Like her peers, Athena is an expert at tuning out her parents so she can focus on her phone. She spent much of her summer keeping up with friends, but nearly all of it was over text or Snapchat. I've been on my phone more than I've been with actual people, she said. My bed has like an imprint of my body. In this, too, she is typical. The number of teens who get together with their friends nearly every day dropped by more than 40% from 2000 to 2015. The decline has been especially steep recently. It's not only a matter of fewer kids partying, fewer kids are spending time simply hanging out. That's something most teens used to do. Nerds and jocks, poor kids and rich kids, C students and A students, the roller rink, the basketball court, the town pool, the local necking spot, they've all been replaced by virtual spaces accessed through apps and the web. You might expect that teens spend too much time in these new spaces because it makes them happy, but most data suggests that it does not. The Monitoring the Future survey, funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse and designed to be nationally representative, has asked 12th graders more than 1,000 questions every year since 1975, and queried 8th and 10th graders since 1991. The survey asked teens how happy they are, and also how much of their leisure time they spend on various activities, including non-screen activities such as in-person social interaction and exercise, and, in recent years, screen activities such as social media, texting, and browsing the web. The results could not be clearer. Teens who spend more time than average on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy, and those who spend more time than average on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. There's not a single exception. All screen activities are linked to less happiness, and all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. Eighth graders who spend 10 or more hours a week on social media are 56% more likely to say they're unhappy than those who devote less time to social media. Admittedly, 10 hours a week is a lot, but those who spend 6 to 9 hours a week on social media are still 47% more likely to say they're unhappy than those who use social media even less. The opposite is true of in-person interactions. Those who spend an above average amount of time with their friends in person are 20% less likely to say they're unhappy than those who hang out for a below average amount of time. The more time teens spend looking at screens, the more likely they are to report symptoms of depression.
You know, this should be self-evident. I mean, the parents should understand it. The kids who went to the ball games, even if they weren't playing, but they went and hung out in the stands. The kids who went to the mall to hang out with their friends. The kids who went to the public pool to hang out together, or, you know, to go to the local roller skating rink. All of these things, and, you know, Steve, you grew up in a Christian school, but you would say that there were these social events.
Youth activities,
things of that nature, where those kids were connected, happy, felt fulfilled, even if they were separated into different groups of interest.
Different cliques,
things of that nature. Then the kids who didn't come to the games, then came to school, felt disconnected from everybody in the school. The loners,
right,
had a tendency to be more unfulfilled. I mean, there was a few loners who were genuinely loners because they could be happy with whatever group they were in and being, I can hang out with you, awesome, I don't have to go to a game and be a part of a clique. If I go to a game, cool. If I don't, cool. I get my fulfillment enough when I'm at school because I'm really an introvert by nature. That would have been me. But we're outliers in that aspect. Most people, though, if you could tell the kids that were at risk for depression, issues, things of that nature, were the kids that were not connected to the social activities around the school, even in public school. That they just, so what he's saying makes absolute sense. Well, now we have it even to a greater degree. Because that's what happens. They come into the public environment of the school classroom, and they're used to doing this, and every school says, hey, I don't know what the method is. You know, our schools, is you leave it in your locker. Some schools, you turn it into the teacher's box.
Or your cell phone.
My cell phone. Or you hang it in a little pocket. So you turn in your cell phone, you turn in your device, now you're in a classroom, and let's have a Socratic discussion. Crickets. Or it's you're dragging it out, because they don't know how to talk to each other. And they're afraid to talk to each other. And they go to lunch, and it's awkward conversations, and it's different things, and now nobody feels connected to anybody. And I don't want to go to that school because I don't have any friends there or anything else. But it's the same person that you're texting with at night. Well, I thought y'all were friends. Well, you know, they don't really get me. It's because you don't spend time together in a quality way. And I'm sorry, the classroom's not going to be that. Or they want to turn the classroom into that replacement, and you can't. So now there's like this whole 8 hours, 9 hours a day, I'm unfulfilled. So I'm going to replace it with all my night, staying up all night, and sleep deprivation, and all the side effects of that start to kick in. I mean, it's a huge mess.
And you know, as you're addressing that, Jackie, I can't help but sit here and think about some of the students that I'm friends with on social media that are homeschoolers, and how there's the traditional, you know, homeschool stereotype or whatever. But even just some of the social media usage between students who, you know, have to go into a school and spend time in classrooms where there is decreased opportunity to be on their phone versus those who are at liberty, and you can even sense that, the difference between those. And, you know, the author addressed the fact of basically more screen time equals higher chance of depression. And the reason why, and it's, I know we've addressed it as a staff, and I've talked about it with the teenagers before, is this concept of FOMO, F-O-M-O, which most of our audience probably has no idea what that is, but it's the fear of missing out. Why in the world does looking at my phone make me more depressed? Because I see something that someone else gets to do, I don't get to do it. I see what fun someone else is having, and I don't get to participate in that. I see what else someone else is eating for dinner, and I don't get to have that.
But you can like it.
Yeah, but that doesn't really, that gives no satisfaction to anyone other than the person who posted the picture. Because, I mean, no one sits around like, yeah, I like 37 pictures today. I mean, that's not the conversation. You have kids that will discuss how much someone liked their photo, and we even have it here with, you know, the turn of the calendar year. Instagram puts out, and I see both sides of it, but Instagram puts out, you know, the ability to check your best nine, which is your nine most liked pictures on Instagram. And, you know, of course, all my adult friends, it's like, you know, someone got engaged or you had a baby or, you know, something, you know, life event type thing. And then you see students.
Completed a Spartan race.
Yeah. you know, something like that. But then you have the younger generation, this iGen, that is, it's completely about themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's no wonder. Okay, and why else would you be depressed? When society tells you, social media tells you, you have to post selfies, pictures of yourself, and then allow other people to affirm you based upon whether or not they double tap your picture.
Or swipe left or right.
Yeah. Well, no wonder you're depressed, because you think everyone has a naturally inflated, you know, opinion of themselves. And when they get a dose of reality, or whatever the case might be, that they don't get that affirmation, it leads to depression.
And I think that one of the things that we haven't talked a lot about, and she referenced it about the dent in her bed where she's permanently in there, is just the lack of moving through physical space. Your body was designed by God to move and to experience movement, and really your body was designed to experience a certain amount of stress and work. And if you know, we all know that if you don't put your body through a certain amount of stress and work, your muscles will atrophy. You know, you'll be overweight, and certainly there are physiological benefits to running, playing, working, and getting kids outdoors. And, you know, that's long been an initiative, but now it's even more challenging because there's, you know, we used to be indoors and we'd be going, we're bored. And mom was like, okay, get outside. You know, get outside because you're bored inside. But now they're not going, we're bored anymore because we got our phones.
And what really kills me is, okay, I'm 48 years old. I have a slip disc or a herniated disc in my lower lumbar back, and the most likely cause is the amount of time I spent in the hospital in the past 6 months. Mm. Because I was in a compressed state of, or I had to be on the couch because I was so sick.
Yeah.
And everything else. Well, we know, we talk about it a lot with adults, the side effects of sitting too long. The Apple Watch now is all like, Buzz, you're ready. Time to stand.
Yeah. Time to breathe.
You know.
And, oh, I forgot.
And the whole thing of it is because we don't get up. We don't move our bodies. So we as adults are realizing this. We're seeing this, and we're seeing the effects of desk jobs. We're seeing the effects of office jobs and cubicles. It's why Google's putting in treadmills and letting them work on desk treadmills in their offices and have slides and these huge break times and looks like McDonald's Playland if you go look at some of their headquarter pictures and things of that nature, because it stimulates creativity. The movement stimulates creativity. It stimulates brain function. A book called Brain Rest.
And it also might factor into the what she said about the aging. Or they're postponing adolescence and getting into adulthood.
But the idea of brain rest was the idea of what you were talking about, John, switching activities.
Right.
So that your brain that's working on a problem can go to the subconscious and continue to work on it because another part of your brain is functioning somewhere else and focus on something else. But the biggest thing that we're seeing is that we know that this inactivity, like you're talking about, the sitting, all of these things are detrimental to our bodies, and yet we're taking the kids who have always been running around playing and everything else, and now we have them sitting at desk jobs. And we let them come home and continue that sitting at a desk job for 14, 15, 16 hours a day, and they're starting it at 8, 9, 7, where we started it at 19, 20, 22, and if it's already having that effect on us in 20 years, what are they going to be like at my age? What is the current 8-year-old going to be like in 40 years? What kind of health problems are they going to have?
Have you seen the movie WALL-E?
And being decrepit.
And the other thing is, and I call this the south end of a northbound mule, okay? Mm. And that is this idea of, we used to have to plow the field,
yeah,
to get our food, right? And how do you plow a field? One step at a time behind that northbound mule, right?
Right.
It's mindless. Does it take a lot of mental acuity to hold that plow in line behind the mule? No. So what you're doing is you got physical activity going on, and then you're mentally thinking about the morning devotions, about that passage you read in the scripture, about the universe, about philosophy. And I contend that all of our past predecessors of thought had some sort of activity like that in their life. Very few of them were just pent up as a scholar in somewhere and just thought and thought and thought.
So Einstein worked, if I remember right from the book Brain Rest, Einstein worked no more than an hour at a time on a problem that he was currently working on. He'd puzzle through it, and then he would always take an equal amount of time of a walk and then come back and pick the problem back up again, and he would have fresh insight.
Right. And I think today, for me personally, the thing that's maybe an equivalent is cutting my own grass. You know, when you're just going back and forth and all you got to really do about it is keeping it overlapping.
It's therapeutic.
You know, it's therapeutic because then what do? You mull over things you've been thinking about. And I think there's something to be said for that type of activity that's just, it's repetitive, so it doesn't need a lot of your mental acuity, but you can put your mind on something while doing them at the same time. And that's, you know, of course, I sound today like an apologetic for an instrumentalist, but that's one thing I think that's great about instrumental music is that it's tactile, you're doing something with your body and your hands, and coordinating with your brain, but you're also thinking. You're thinking through the musical phrase. You're thinking through the emotions behind the music. You know, why did the person write this? You know, like a Schindler's List song has a different idea behind it than, you know, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Yeah. And so I guess what I'm saying is you're operating in space on different planes, but what we've come down to is we're operating on a very thin plane, mentally and physically, and we're like very sedimentary when we're doing this.
If you're going to give advice for a happy adolescent based on this survey, it would be straightforward. Put down the phone, turn off the laptop, and do something, anything, that does not involve a screen. Of course, these analyses don't unequivocally prove that screen time causes unhappiness. It's possible that unhappy teens spend more time online, but recent research suggests that screen time, in particular social media use, does indeed cause unhappiness. One study asked college students with a Facebook page to complete short surveys on their phone over the course of 2 weeks. They'd get a text message with a link 5 times a day and report their mood and how much they'd used Facebook. The more they'd used Facebook, the unhappier they felt. But feeling unhappy did not subsequently lead to more Facebook use. Social networking sites like Facebook promise to connect us to friends, but the portrait of iGen teens emerging from the data is one of a lonely, dislocated generation. Teens who visit social networking sites every day but see their friends in person less frequently are the most likely to agree with the statements, "A lot of times I feel lonely. I often feel left out of things. And I often wish I had more good friends." Teens' feelings of loneliness spiked in 2013 and have remained high since. This doesn't always mean that on an individual level, kids who spent more time online are lonelier than kids who spend less time online. Teens who spend more time on social media also spend more time with their friends in person. On average, highly social teens are more social in both venues, and less social teens are less so. But at the generational level, when teens spend more time on smartphones and less time on in-person social interactions, loneliness is more common. So is depression. Once again, the effect of screen activities is unmistakable. The more time teens spend looking at screens, the more likely they are to report symptoms of depression. Eighth graders who are heavy users of social media increase their risk of depression by 27%, while those who play sports, go to religious services, or even do homework more than the average teen cut their risk significantly. Teens who spend 3 hours a day or more on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have a risk factor for suicide, such as making a suicide plan. That's much more than the risk related to, say, watching TV. One piece of data that indirectly but stunningly captures kids' growing isolation for good and for bad. Since 2007, the homicide rate among teens has declined, but the suicide rate has increased. As teens have started spending less time together, they have become less likely to kill one another and more likely to kill themselves. In 2011, for the first time in 24 years, the teen suicide rate was higher than the teen homicide rate. Depression and suicide have many causes. Too much technology is clearly not the only one. And the teen suicide rate was even higher in the 1990s, long before smartphones existed. Then again, about 4 times as many Americans now take antidepressants, which are often effective in treating severe depression, the type most strongly linked to suicide.
Brian, can we stop for a second? My thought process on this is, in looking at the data of suicide rate even higher in the 90s, before smartphones existed, than it is now. Okay, I would love to see if the digestion of negativity has anything to do with this process. we all know that Facebook, by and large, is the negative out spewing of most people's lives. So if I go on there, everybody's telling me, you should care about my life, you should care about my life, you should care about my life, you should care about my life. It's negative, 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 negative. Or we're sharing posts. This politician's bad, this political group's bad, this is bad, that's bad, this other thing's bad. Hey, oh, by the way, hey, all these health apps and everything else are feeding in there and saying, hey, you should have this body, you should have that body, you should have this other body. It's all constantly in the feed. And we know that Christ said what we put into our heart comes out. It becomes our actions. So there's this heavy digestion of negativity. Okay, now, I'm not up to date with current music and pop culture, but I wasn't yet devoted to Christ to such a degree that I didn't have a heavy dosage of 80s music and 90s music into the early 90s. So in the 80s, the music that we first get, the Walkmans with the cassette tapes, we get the boom boxes that we're carrying around, and those kind of things. The Discman finally came out. And we have the first time we have this ability to have our own personal jukebox in our ears, on our way, and we're feeding into our bodies. As a teenager, I didn't know this effect on me. And we're feeding this in. But the 80s music was all like, hey, we're going to make it. Nobody's going to stop me. This is great. The decade of wealth, decade of excess, the decade of, you know what I mean, over the top, everything else. And then we had the pendulum swing to the 90s, where we had the grunge movement. Everything, you know, anti-society, you know, everything. Kurt Cobain, the hero of the grunge movement, commits suicide. I mean, it's just, it was very depressive music. This is when the emo music first came out. The goth movement became huge. And all of these things. And so, is it any wonder that the children of the 90s who were being fed negativity all the time are suicidal? And today's teens who are in social media, and it's all about how society's bad and the world is bad and everything's bad, and the government's, you know, you can't trust the government because they're gonna draft us into World War III, and just on and on and on it goes. And it's all about how your life is not fulfilled. And then on top of it,
Nobody liked my post.
And I put it down, and I go over here, and I don't know how to talk to you. So we're all going to just sit kind of awkward at the lunch table and eat, and we're going to talk. And if we do talk, what we're going to do is we're going to complain.
Yeah.
Or what I also see a lot is talking about the social media. Did you see this?
Yes. And it's a constant digestion of negative. So why are we surprised that they're depressed and suicidal?
And then people my age, all we do when we go to a dinner is talk about food, which I've never understood.
Or health.
Brian's already there. I got my glasses, I got my this. I'm just falling apart, and I'm 31.
I need them for a computer screen and nighttime driving. And even that's only to keep my eyes from getting...
Enjoy it.
But
Jack, I think a lot of it too, and she brought it up in the article, that many, I'm not going to say all, I'm not going to broad brush, but the majority of parents aren't talking to their children.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what she, you know, they're staring at their phone and going, and they're not paying attention to anything the child's saying. So the child grows up going, oh, well, that must, you know, I don't have to communicate. I can just go,
Yeah,
so I'm
coaching this baseball clinic on the weekends, right? And I'm coaching these five catchers, these young elementary age catchers, and they're all in the room. And I'm like, okay, it's your turn on the platform, because we had this massive pad type of thing that was cushioned for them to, you know, drop on their knees and stuff with. So I was like, your turn on the platform. That's what we call it, the platform. It's your turn to get up on the platform, right? So this one kid goes, I don't want to go next. And somebody's like, oh, it's okay, man. It's okay. He's like, no, everybody's looking at me. And this one kid goes, not that guy. He hasn't looked up from his phone all day. He pointed out one of the dads. Oh, the dad was like,
Whoops.
Well, you know, and that's another good point, because this comes to parents, because it's not just teenagers. You know, I was reminded when we just had Christmas and we had all the young kids at my house, all the grandkids at my house, and what did they want to do? Hey, Grandpa, would you go outside and do the scooter with me? Would you go outside and play with me? And my temptation was, hey, let's get these kids in front of this TV and get them to shut up so I don't have to go outside. Because what was I? I was lazy. I'd worked all day. When I came home, I just wanted to relax. But you've got to fight it. You have to fight it. And the way that you fight it is you think about eternity. You think about 20 years from now. And are your children going to remember, or your grandchildren going to remember, when you went outside and fell on the skateboard in front of them because you were trying to do the crazy skateboard too?
Grandpa, we need you to come to work the next morning.
Or when you did performed the ollie flawlessly, or the kickflip or whatever, and they're like, "What? You can do that too?" Yeah, I used to be a kid. We used to go outside and skateboard for hours, but. You know,
kids, remember, it hurts more when you fall.
It does. But it's about example. And, you know, we want to chime in and say, these kids. But really, they're watching our example.
They are.
Right.
And, you know, and I find myself looking at my phone way too much. And, you know, you're making excuses. Well, I need this for work. Someone's going to text me about the sound coming from the back of the auditorium or whatever. And you think, 20 years ago, I didn't have this. I operated full time without this, so just I can do without it. I can put it in my car.
20 years ago, they just got up, walked around, and found you in your seat and tugged on your
in mine. But you know, you say that, John. And my grandfather, I remember having a conversation with my grandfather, and he said, and I said something about a big city something. I forget what it was, New York City, L.A., something to that effect. Because I've always had this fascination with big cities. And what life is like there, and how it really stinks to be in this town with nothing to do. I grew up in a town that's a fraction of the size of Fayetteville. So when I hear people talk about Fayetteville, I have nothing. I'm like, dude, you should come to my hometown.
Let's go to the silo. Look at the grain.
Rock quarry. We're going swimming. And you had that situation coming up. And he said, look, the only reason you're unfulfilled is because you watch that stupid TV.
That tells you what New York City's like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everything else. So he grew up in a time when, pre-TV. And he says people are more unhappy now because they know what's happening in the other places of the world more instantaneously, so they have a natural tendency to feel less fulfilled.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's only grown exponentially with the internet and smartphones and constantly never being disconnected from what could be elsewhere. To being happy where you are.
And I think another piece of that is because of the amount of information we can get, that things that have long been considered great items of thought and works of art are now, because they took so long to develop. Like, it took you, when you were a kid, it took you a while to find John Locke's works and other works of philosophy and, Beethoven's and other people and C.S. Lewis and people who have impacts upon, human thought. It took you a while to find that, but now you can instantly, and you have no idea, this so-and-so is saying this, and I've got this, Paradise Lost, and they're set right side by side, and so people tend to think they're equal. Oh, and they're not. They're not at all equal. And it's really hard for a teenager to discern that.
Right. Yeah.
Because it takes a while to read Paradise Lost, and it takes a little interpretation and teaching.
Yeah, kind of what's sad, though, is our children today don't know anything different. They don't know how to turn it off.
No.
Yeah. You know, like Jack, what you were saying, your grandfather and even you as a child, me, Jonathan, 20 years ago, yeah, we didn't have a smartphone.
There was a point when it was turned off. Get out of the house.
Right, but, you worked, you came to work from 8 to 5, you went home and nobody bothered you.
Oh yeah, what did I tell Angela? We got our first cell phone in 1998, I think it was, or 97, and the only reason we bought them, and they were prepaid cards.
Right.
Like I had to constantly keep prepaid payments on, and then we finally went to a payment plan, to have a constant thing, because I went TDY every month across the country.
Right.
and I was in Germany.
Right.
So we got them so that I could stay in touch. Hey, I'm here safe, or if I broke down on the road or whatever, I could get to my unit, I could get to my wife, I could get somebody to help me out kind of thing. And it was a true tool. And it was only a phone.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the idea of when it became more and more and more. And I told her the other day, I was like, I wish I had never bought my first cell phone. So that we had just stayed landline.
Yeah, but
we can't imagine surviving without
right,
it now.
Right, and you can't and maintain and stay up with.
Let's test it out for a week and see.
That reminds me of Green Acres. You remember the phone line on there? Everything about Green Acres 49. Is funny.
All right, what are your thoughts? What are your comments? Post them right underneath this article, and let us know what you're thinking. And appreciate you listening, tuning in today. Have a great day.